Bienvenidos a la segunda temporada de Encuentros, un podcast para disfrutar del espacio Fundación Telefónica, donde y cuando quieras.
En estos momentos, el 70% de las emisiones de carbono viene de las ciudades. Las urbes son claramente causa importante de la crisis climática. En la misma medida, también pueden convertirse en gran parte de la solución. ¡Arrancamos! Dinamarca, a la cabeza en sostenibilidad y transición ecológica, tiene en su capital uno de los mejores ejemplos de cómo una ciudad es capaz de poner en marcha distintas soluciones para reducir las emisiones de CO2 y luchar de manera eficiente contra el cambio climático. En el episodio de hoy de nuestro Foro Telos 2021, Jacob Normann Jansen, uno de los directivos del Centro Nórdico para el Urbanismo Sostenible Blockshop, nos cuenta cómo Copenhague no ha sido siempre ni mucho menos tal y como ahora la conocemos, a la vez que nos muestra algunas de las actuaciones que le han llevado al liderazgo en materia medioambiental. Pero lo más interesante, sin duda, es ver cómo estas soluciones no solo no dañan la economía y no requieren de ninguna renuncia, sino que incluso mejoran el nivel de vida y sobre todo la calidad en cuanto a habitabilidad y salud de las personas. Muchas de estas soluciones al final resulta que son las más sencillas, las más obvias y las más atractivas. Eso sí, precisan de cooperación, consenso y voluntad política. Y lo suyo es que partan de los deseos de los ciudadanos. Una charla inspiradora en colaboración con la Embajada de Dinamarca que se desarrolla en inglés y que a veces alude a imágenes que no son necesarias para seguirla, pero que puedes visualizar en nuestro canal de YouTube, donde tienes además una versión doblada al castellano. Que la disfrutes.
Buenas tardes.
Thanks and good evening, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's a great honor to be able to introduce Denmark and Copenhagen.
English, because I think otherwise it would be a bit embarrassing. I do understand some Spanish. I was actually a student here in Madrid many years ago. I studied in Autónoma de Madrid. But it was actually so long ago that we could walk into our favorite bar and order tres minis por mil pesetas. So then you can kind of count back how long that was. But I really enjoyed my time here in Madrid, and I enjoyed also the urban life in Madrid. Madrid has an urban pulse that is quite unique. I think coming from Copenhagen, I have never experienced a traffic jam at 3 o'clock at night. So I really enjoyed this time, and urban life is also what I'm going to talk to you about a little bit today. But Copenhagen is a smaller city than Madrid. It's still the capital of Copenhagen, but I think we are not that much out in the public space. We are maybe also a little bit more reserved. We don't give dos pesos, for example. We give handshakes. And I read an article in El País, actually, about Copenhagen, because Denmark was one of the first countries to lift the corona restrictions some months ago, and there was apparently the joke among Spanish people in living in Copenhagen was that now that we had these restrictions lifted, with we had to keep two meters of distance between each other, now the Danes could go back to the usual 5 meters of distance. So just about me, shortly, besides having studied here in Spain, I've worked with international relations my whole career. I've worked with the European Commission in Ethiopia. I've done projects in Zambia, and I've also for several periods worked for the city of Copenhagen on collaboration on environmental issues. So focusing on how cities can collaborate to cut CO2 emissions and avert the climate crisis. I will use the Copenhagen as a case today, but I don't represent Copenhagen. As you heard, I represent Blockshop. And Bloxhub is Bloxhub was created to make a new platform for how we work and how we innovate sustainable cities. It's about creating a platform for collaboration, breaking down the silos and making people work across sectors and across also national borders. We usually say that we have three layers, or you can consider Bloxhub to be three layers. We have a co-working space in this building you see here with about 120 different organizations, and then a wider group or a wider community of membership organizations both in Denmark and abroad, and then finally a network, a global network of partners and like-minded organizations. But what they all have in common is that we work within urban development, whether it's a startup, like a one-person startup, or a corporate, or a research organization, or if it's the climate organization C40, which you might know, who work for the main, or it's the main climate organization for cities. We have this in common, and we need to work together to create new solutions and to accelerate the green transition. So we need many different perspectives on urban development issues. That is the motivation. No one can do this alone. We each hold a piece of the puzzle. And if we can get architects, for example, to work with engineers and tech companies and researchers, we have a much better platform for accelerating the green transition, and especially in cities. So my message today is that sustainable cities are inherently irresistible. And with the right choice, it's also, or with the right approach, it's also the right the right choice or the obvious choice. I will give you some examples from Copenhagen today on how Copenhagen has worked with becoming, or the journey that Copenhagen has been on to become a more sustainable city and a more livable city, and use that also as a case to how we can approach sustainable urbanization from now on. Because cities can sometimes be seen as symbols of everything that is wrong with the environment and the climate crisis. I tried to check the weather in New Delhi the other day, and it didn't say sunny, or it didn't say cloudy, it just said smoke. So I think cities are often have a bad reputation for being some of the root causes of the climate crisis, but there's a kind of a dichotomy to that, because they are also, I think they also hold many of the solutions. Cities are actually per capita less straining for the environment. We transport ourselves less. We work, or we live in smaller places and consume less resources. So there's also an opportunity we need to explore. And I think if we do it in the right way, I think actually the urban life can be one of the solutions to the climate crisis. But I will try to take you on a journey with Copenhagen's development, because at least we consider Copenhagen now to be a quite sustainable city and a quite livable city. And we are often in these international competitions or indexes. Copenhagen always comes out very well as a livable and a sustainable city. But that actually hasn't been the case for that many years. Already back in the 80s, Copenhagen had a lot of problems. For one thing, it was almost bankrupt. It was a very a dirty city. This is a picture of the harbor front in Copenhagen, and it was It was a very industrial place, and the harbor and the water. I think if you fell in the water, you would probably have to go to the hospital because it was so polluted by all these industries. But in crisis, sometimes lies opportunity, and Copenhagen took, and also the Danish state took some actions in the 90s to revert this. This development. One thing is actually they made a whole new model for urban development by developing public lands and actually using the proceeds from these lands to create the infrastructure. So whole new areas of Copenhagen have been built, built also as sustainable areas. So that was one thing, and the other actually was that. The whole harbor front, which is, I mean, Copenhagen has a harbor on the outside, but also water running through the city. So it's a very vital part of urban life in Copenhagen, unlike Madrid, of course. But what they did was to actually clean up the harbor. So removing the industry, renovating the sewer system so that all the sewage didn't go into the harbor. And this is how it looks today. From being a very unhealthy place, it is now a recreational area. From being a place that actually split the city in two, now it draws the city together. So I think that was the first kind of major step that happened in Copenhagen towards this or this journey to become livable and sustainable. In the years since, there have been built a lot of harbor baths. The whole harbor front has been kind of a vital part of urban development in Copenhagen, both in terms of sustainability, but also in terms of this urban life. And another thing. That was a bit later, actually, in 2009, and there was also just mentioned before that Copenhagen adopted a climate plan. It was back then; it was one of the first cities to have a climate plan. And it was definitely the first city to try to achieve this goal of climate neutrality. And I won't bore you with how you calculate climate neutrality, but in essence, of course, it's you don't, as a city, you don't emit, or you go in zero, you don't emit more than you invest in, for example, in wind power. Back then, it was also a huge undertaking. How do you become climate neutral as a city? Much of it, of course, relates to energy production. So you need to produce a lot of clean energy to become carbon neutral. You need to invest in wind energy. Copenhagen had a lot of, for example, coal-fired power plants. So the city doesn't own all these power plants. So you had to work with partners and convince them to make investments in refurbishing these power plants. So I think the this development had already started before the climate plan, but a conscious decision was made to try to achieve climate neutrality. And actually, I think one of the unique things was that there was a political agreement or broad consensus about this, that this needs to be done. And when we receive people from other cities and other countries, that's kind of what stands in the way, and you need some basic political consensus to do this, because if you have a climate plan and then the new municipal government comes in after 4 years and rejects the plan, it doesn't really work. But I think the basis of the climate plan is that it's not something to do with lowering economic development. So the experience has been that actually the economic development has grown, but still the emissions have gone down, and even with the population growth actually in Copenhagen, it has been possible to reduce emissions, and I think that's also some of the considerations we hear from other cities. Well, doesn't this hurt economic development, and seeing it as kind of as a break on wealth and on standard of living? But I think the some of the evidence we've seen here is that it is actually possible to reduce without harming economic development. One of the things actually that was really useful was to implement district heating in Copenhagen. And right now we have a 99% of all buildings, or at least homes in Copenhagen, they are warmed by district heating. That's unparalleled anywhere in any other city. But the city decided also to really make this a priority and legislate about this. So it became the most obvious choice to become or to be connected to the district heating grid, and by that also creating a basis for climate neutrality, because you have this heating grid, you have a much more flexible energy system. And you can do much more with wind energy and use it as an energy reserve as well. So I think that has been really helpful in getting emissions down in Copenhagen. And when we talk about district heating and making the sustainable choice also the most obvious choice and the most irresistible choice. A few years ago, a power plant was created in actually very near the center of Copenhagen. We call it Copenhill, but it's a waste incineration plant. So all the waste we can't recycle, it goes there, and it's, of course, it's burned and it's turned into district heating and electricity as well. But in line with this thinking as well, they said, well, we need to have this structure. How can we also make it useful for the citizens of Copenhagen? So now we actually have a skiing hill in Copenhagen with, of course, it's artificial grass, but in Copenhagen or in Denmark, it's a big deal because we don't really have any mountains. This was an idea by the architect Bjarke Ingels, and he had this phrase of hedonistic sustainability, and I think it's also what we are talking about here, that sustainability doesn't have to be in expense of something else. It doesn't have to be something that you where you give up some other resources or some other goals you are fighting for in your city. So Copenhill, I think, is a milestone in this development towards seeing sustainable choices as the most also the most irresistible and the most livable choice. Another thing I just wanted to talk about is biking. Copenhagen is now known for being a very bike-friendly city. You also mentioned some statistics, but that actually hasn't always been the case either. In the beginning of the century, there were many bikes in Copenhagen, but like many other industrialized countries, cars started to come in. Public spaces turned into parking lots. Cars were everywhere in the city, but I think there was a cultural change also on this sustainability journey of Denmark in general, that there was a public pressure to improve conditions, for example, for cycling and getting rid of cars in the city. So that was something that politicians picked up on and started to being really active and progressive in terms of creating infrastructure for biking after the turn of the millennium. So now we are it is a high priority in the city council, and it looks a little bit like let's see if maybe if you can in this technic room put on the video. This is a normal rush hour in Copenhagen, and you can just imagine if all these bikes had to go to or be in cars, and if, when you know how much space cars takes up in the street, this is actually the obvious choice now. This is how this is the fastest way to get around Copenhagen. And there's a general agreement that this is what we want and how we want it to continue. Another example is that I think for cities, if you build the infrastructure, you can really facilitate this development. You have to make the irresistible choice also the easiest choice. We've started now to building a lot of bridges in Copenhagen only for bikes and pedestrians. This was when I was working for the city of Copenhagen, this was built, and the assumption was that about 7,000 bikes would cross it every day, but in reality it's more like 20,000. So and it has completely changed the flow of people in the city and how they move about. So I think that's just also a good lesson for both for practitioners and policymakers, that the infrastructure and political decisions really matter if you want to create a sustainable city. And it's not just the most, I think, the most obvious choice. It's also the best choice if you really look at it evidence-based. What is the result of these policies? And we've looked a lot into this. What is actually what are the effects of cycling on the population, on health, and so on? And if you compare an investment into, for example, a bike lane compared to a road, it's a much better payoff. So the society saves money on health costs, for example. There are less sick days because people are more healthy. They live longer and also are generally happier. So again, this should be the obvious choice. It's just how do you facilitate that choice as a municipal government or as a national government. And the funny thing is, if you ask Copenhageners why they bike, they don't say normally that it's because of the environment. I know that's the case in many other countries, but it's actually because it's easier and it's faster. And I think that was really central to the to the message here, that this is how it has to be. If you build a system of sustainability around wanting to do something for the environment, I think it's not sustainable. It has to be the best choice, has to be the most obvious choice. And you can see that the eco-friendliness is actually only 16%, so that's way down on the list. So I think this development has continued. As I said, a number of bridges, and the whole infrastructure is now, I think, is very much built up on around bikes and around pedestrians, and of course around the harbor front. So again, changing the flow of the city, make it more easy for people to get around on sustainable means of transportation. And in that process also improving health and improving livability. Another thing when you talk about sustainability, not just making or reducing emissions, is also, you know, all know that climate change is already here. We have to deal with the consequences also of the climate crisis. I think we are more fortunate than many other countries, for example, in Africa where I've worked. But still, we do see the effects now, and especially around cloudbursts. We had a big rain event, for example, in Denmark in 10 years ago, which took everyone by surprise. This is where the photo is from, and I think it was really an eye opener for practitioners and policymakers that this is something we should invest in, because one day of rainfall in Copenhagen costs the taxpayers about €1 billion. So I think that the business case for making these investments suddenly became clear. But what was the approach to dealing with the climate effects in Copenhagen, I think in Denmark in general, has not been to just drill a lot of holes or put in some pipes for rainwater. This was actually seen as a way to improve the city. Again, that from crisis comes opportunity. We knew that we had to secure the city against these extreme rainfall events. But the way it was done was to actually see it as an opportunity to create some new urban spaces. So a number of parks, for example, have been built in Copenhagen that has a dual purpose. One is to retain water from these extreme events, but also to create a new green spaces in Copenhagen. And that's also a good business case, because it's about 50% cheaper to do climate adaptation on the surface as compared to drilling or laying pipes in the ground. So again, this is the obvious choice and the best choice. You just have to approach it in the right way. This is another example of a park being built in Copenhagen now, and we have many members in our community in Bloxup that are working with these issues both in Copenhagen and abroad. And I think we are very, very fortunate to have this fantastic ecosystem of companies and organizations with these great skills of seeing these challenges as also opportunities, and seeing the human perspective. So how does this new project or new infrastructure affect the person living in the city? I think you always need to have that perspective. So we are almost in 2025 now, not so many years left, and we often get the question, so will you reach the target? And I think the best choice or the best answer is probably almost. The last few percents are always the most difficult. But in any case, this doesn't stop here. So, and actually, when the climate plan was made in Copenhagen, it was kind of the first wave of climate plans. So we didn't really know how to calculate this. I mean, what is climate neutrality, and what do you have to put into this equation? And so that's where we're going now, because one thing is what the power plants emit and what kind of emissions comes from transport, but we are all citizens in a city. We buy our clothes, we buy our food and so on. So I think one of the next steps is to look at consumer-based emissions, and that's going to be really interesting to see how can a city work with the emissions that all the citizens create, or the carbon footprint in their ordinary lives. Of course, also getting these last percent or reducing even more and creating wind power and so on. And there are a lot of new opportunities, new ways to incorporate technology, for example, in transport. To do things a little bit more smart now than when this plan was created in 2009. So, So I'm really excited to see what the city comes up with. But in any case, I think the ambitions are high. The Copenhagen still wants to be in the forefront of this, because cities, as I said, it is where most people live. It's where it's 70% of emissions are based from cities, but it's also an enormous opportunity to avert the climate crisis. You can't really you can't disregard the cities, the role of the cities in this in this development. So, but whatever whatever we've done in Copenhagen and in other cities in Denmark and in Europe, I think we are becoming aware now that this is not enough. We have to move up to the in the next gear. Where we have to. The crisis is so grave that something else has to be done. We are also overshooting. It's not just about the climate crisis. It's also about the resources we use. I think in July 29th this year, we kind of used the resources on our planet that we are allowed to use if we are supposed to be sustainable. So we are overshooting. We have to do something radically different about how we live. But I think actually that this approach of seeing the sustainable solution as the obvious choice and the irresistible solution can be a good foundation for also making this radical change. Because we have to look at the whole system. We have to design a new system, and we have to go circular. And actually, I'm not the only one who thinks that. There has been recently a new project from the European Union called New European Bauhaus, where the climate crisis and an environmental crisis is also seen as a cultural project to solve. So it's not just a technical solution, but we have to change kind of the way we live. We have to change the whole value chain, and that calls for a different kind of solution and different kinds of design. So how do we do that? We have to design new markets, we call it design the irresistible circular society. So we talk about three different things when we talk about or angles of action when we talk about the irresistible circular society. So that's social value and communities. It's city nature, resilience and biodiversity, and it's resource loops and zero waste. So we have to work with or create some involvement from the make the citizens be part of this journey. They have to own the process. If the citizens don't feel an ownership of designing new systems, it won't be sustainable and it won't achieve the targets that we are aiming for. City nature, I think it's important. We are also facing a biodiversity crisis. So nature, we have to take care of nature, not just for the sake of nature, but also for our health. And we need to look at the resource loops. We are building new districts, new buildings all the time. But they have to last much longer. They have to last the next 100 years. We have to renovate smarter, and still do it as in a way that is aesthetically pleasing and supporting the good life in the city. I think that has also been part of the journey for many sustainable cities, that it has to support what the citizens define as a good life. So whether it's swimming in the harbor or biking or having clean air, I think that has to be the focus. So in we've started in Denmark a lot of organizations on this common mission of designing the circular society, and the reason we say design is actually to that if you see this as a design problem, then you also look at the systemic level. You include what are the needs of the citizens, what are the desires. That is what you do when you design stuff to be useful for to be relevant for the user. We have to think about in a bit the same way about our system, our economic system, and how we create this this value chain. So we are, but of course nobody can do it alone, and I think it has to be a really a broad-based mobilization, a broad-based movement, not just in Denmark and the Nordics or Europe for that sake. It has to many different partners and players have to be part of it. I know that we would like to work with Spanish organizations, with all the good initiatives and also design thinking we experience from Spain to be part of this movement. So this is also, I think, an invitation to Spain from Denmark and from Scandinavia to join this movement. And I think finally. And that's now I'm coming back to where I work, Blocks Up, because I think this requires an enormous amount of partnership building and innovation. We have to kind of break up the ways we have been working. We have to look at these challenges from new perspectives. We have to include many different types of knowledge. We have to include research much more, or get researchers to talk much more with companies and policymakers. We have to improve the relationship between technology and design. So that's something we've been working on, or started to work on in Blocks Up. For example, we've worked with a university in New York State, who had an ambition to become the first circular university in Northern America. And there are so many aspects to this, and how do the students, how do they buy into this process? What are the resources through the campus, and what are the business models? So we need to get many people in the same room and create these new types of partnerships to create a truly irresistible circular society. So I hope also we can work with organizations in Spain and other parts in Southern Europe on this. At least if we are very committed to this process also with the backing of the European Union, I think we can go very far together. So that's I think that's it for me. Any questions? Yes?
What I would like you to answer is about participative democracy, mm-hmm. citizens helping, not only the town halls and the partnerships mm-hmm. into all that, but also really the citizens into the cities to have a voice. Mm. To say something about what I want for my city to.
So is how we can create participation?
How do you integrate that?
I think it's a very good question, and I think it's a very big challenge, because I think there has been a traditional way for also for cities to include citizens, and it has been to have these advisory meetings where you where people can come and voice their opinions. I think that's good, but it hasn't been sufficient. So one thing is usually the same people that come to these meetings and give their voices. So I think it has been a challenge to have a representative participation. Well, I know that there are many cities in Denmark and elsewhere that are working on new tools to increase participation, and also looking at it a little bit broader and actually also using technology. So we have one of our members that work with what they call soft city sensing. So that is taking data from, for example, from social media. If you go down to Gran Via, you would maybe have people put pictures on Instagram and writing different things. So developing a system for how can that data tell us something about how people use the area, what are their opinions, and what are their needs in urban development. But dialogue is still important, and also I think investing in participation, actually using the resource, not just having a meeting, but actively pursuing people and going into the streets and asking about people's opinions in the city. I think that there has been a movement in the last 10 years towards much more active role for cities. Yes.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask, what are the, you know, the most significant challenges to translate all this experience from Copenhagen to the largest cities in the developing world, like São Paulo, Mexico City, Delhi, Lagos, and Johannesburg, not only in terms of resources, but also the policymaking scenario. Thanks.
I think you can never just copy things, and I think that the reality, for example, in Denmark is different from Lagos. But now I was talking about biking, and we are fortunate also to have a lot of companies that work with other countries, and they often get this. Well, many other cities say, well, we can't do that here. It's too hot, there are too many hills, or something like that. And that is correct in some sense, that conditions are different. But you can take some of the, for example, the core measures, you have to make it the obvious choice. You have to work with how people, like putting the person in the center. There was one project in New York City, actually on, I don't know if you remember, before there was just one big traffic mess, so there was a lot of cars in Times Square, and one of the companies, they had the approach of saying, okay, we make this temporary, we temporarily remove the cars and make some a public space with tables and people can sit and enjoy themselves. And in that way, they avoided a lot of protests, but then people got used to it. So they started to say, well, maybe we don't want to go back. So that's, and I know it's a small example, but I think you have to really understand what are the citizens, what are their needs, what are they thinking, what are their desires, and work with that. So don't copy, but use some common principles.
Hello.
Hello.
So you say that for the sustainability of the cities, you need, amongst others, the political willingness to do so. So I don't see in my city, in Madrid, such political willingness, at least now, but What do you see the opportunities for a city like Madrid to transit to a more sustainability city?
Well, I think a lot of things have happened in Madrid. But you're right. It is a question of political will. I think also, well, politicians they tend to listen to their voters. So I think for one thing, if there is a pressure from beneath to do something, if you can speak louder than some of the entrenched interests, then I think. I think there are opportunities, and also maybe making some space for innovation. For as I mentioned, like this temporary project, but working with a city can also decide to try out new things, make a pilot project, or maybe close off the city streets one day of the week, or something like that. So I think you can do it gradually. But I think the most effective tool is popular pressure. All right. I think that was it. If you don't have any more questions, it's been a pleasure to be able to speak to you today. I hope a lot more collaboration between Northern and Southern Europe on these issues. Thank you.
Encuentros, un podcast para disfrutar del espacio Fundación Telefónica, donde y cuando quieras.